Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, William English. The following is a recording which I made last year with avant-garde filmmaker and theoretician Peter Guidall, describing several anxiety-inducing incidents involving lost books.
September, it is 1:10. We're in the Curzon Soho on Shaftesbury Avenue, and this is Peter Guidall.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is, I hope this is okay, just talk about, since it's supposed to be about books, according to William, this is going to be about the anxiety of lost books. Lost, mislaid, stolen, because there's so much anxiety. This happens to be a very anxious week for me, so this is perfect. Because I'm so anxious anyway, I figured I'd talk about something that's anxious. And that's going to be the anxiety of books that are lost, stolen, that disappear. So this is five book stories. I'm assuming it's supposed to be book dealers' stories. Is it? That what they're meant to be?
Yes.
That's what the subject is.
Anything relating to books in however bleak a way you like, or
for a book fair.
It can be...
Is it around books, book dealing, book fair?
Yes. Well, it's for a podcast.
But,
for the London Artists Book Fair.
Fantastic.
At the Whitechapel.
Okay.
Feel free to digress.
That's great. No, I won't.
I'll
try to make this pretty succinct. So it's the anxiety of lost books, or for lost books. So I'm just going to go through these. Different stories of things that got lost and never arrived or showed up, and maybe I can share some of the anxiety just by telling the story. Maybe that won't cause any anxiety, which would be very upsetting. Okay, so one thing was a catalog called Monochrome und Feuer by Yves Klein, or Yves Klein, as some call him for some reason, but anyway, and it's a catalog from the late 50s, or very early 60s, where Klein, the blue paintings, Klein, did a catalog for a show, a retrospective, a big show in Germany, and inside this little catalog were three original pieces, one pink, one gold, and one blue. The gold one was hand-applied gold leaf, and which Klein applied himself, so it's a very rare catalog by now. So it's maybe not a book, it's a catalog. But anyway, I ordered it to put in one of my book catalogs, and I'd always been looking for a copy. And also, often the gold is forged because you can buy gold leaf and stick it on a piece of paper, and it's very hard to tell whether it's the gold leaf from the late 50s or the gold leaf from now, unless you get the paper right, which isn't so hard either. And this was definitely from a very, very good Swiss collector who got it at the time at the show, so it was a real kosher, good, proper one, and I was very pleased to find it. And I ordered it from Switzerland from a dealer I know who has a tiny little shop on a bridge in Zurich, where I grew up. A very lovely guy, and he had one, and we knew where it came from another person we all knew, so I ordered it and bought it. It was very, very expensive, and had it sent and told him to fully insure it, and the Swiss, knowing how to do the post, unlike, you know, us here getting our mail 3 years later, the London Review of Books arrives, but there it arrives in time, and there's no strikes, and it's all very ordered, very boring, but the mail works. So I said, but don't forget to insure it. So he did, and sent it, and it never arrived. And after 2 weeks, we thought, what the fuck's going on? And he checked in the Swiss Post Office. And the Swiss Post Office, where he checked, said, this has never happened before in his little village outside Zurich, in Thalwil. This has never happened before. They can't find any of the paperwork for that day's mailings. And so they couldn't find any proof that he'd mailed it or any paperwork that it had been sent. So he went into paroxysms of anxiety himself, because this is Switzerland, the post. The one thing they can do is post. So finally, the next day, he went back again, and they found the paperwork for that day, and they found that he'd insured it, but instead of insuring it for £2,000, the equivalent in francs, he had thought everything so okay, he insured it for £500. So he insured it for about a quarter to a fifth of what it was worth then, and to me it was worth about double that, because in England that was about a £4,500 item. So here we have now a £4,500 item insured for £500 and lost, and it never turned out. And that's it. And that's the end of the story. and it was finished. So that disappeared. Gone. And he got £500 from the Swiss Post Office. And I felt so bad. I sent him a copy. At that point, I had a lot of copies. Also, strangely enough, from Switzerland, of a book called Drawings by Basquiat. So there are 1,000 signed copies published by around the corner, in fact, from where he was at Bischofsberger. And I had, at that time, at least 24 left. So I sent him one, just because I felt so bloody awful. So just because he felt very bad because he underinsured his parcel. So he lost. I lost. He lost. We all lost. Anyway, so that's the one. That's very anxious. Gone. Swiss Post Office. Never found. Never traced. Never tracked. Nothing. Into the blue yonder. Yves Klein blue. Gone. Next story, Gursky's Montparnasse. German photographer, so-called artist. Did a book called Montparnasse, about, I'd say, 18 inches long, 6 inches high, silver box inside two little catalogs, and for a show he did, and a large photograph called Montparnasse, but it's not a photograph, although now it's constantly sold as with an original photograph. It's actually an offset print, like every other print in a book. It's a color print, but it's cut out on a piece of cardboard, and it's a picture of Montparnasse building by Gursky with all these flats, thousands of flats with different things, and laundry hanging there, and people smoking and making love or killing each other, whatever they do in Montparnasse. It was a huge apartment building, and I found a copy in next in the corner here by any amount of books for 35 quid once, and I already had another copy from the publisher. I think it was published at 70 quid, but... So that's not a very valuable book, but it's a lovely book and catalog and everything else. And when I was living in Paris for a year, the year it came out, they had done 35 copies, each with an original photograph in it, a small 3-inch by 3-inch photograph of one of the apartments that are in the large photograph. Each, there were hundreds of apartments, and 30 of them he did a small 3x3 enlargement, almost like a close-up of a photograph with a very long lens, so you could just about see a reading lamp and a person hunched over it. Very enigmatic, lovely, not Gursky-like at all, photographs. And there were 30 or 35 originally in the limited edition that came, and I ordered it from Paris, and it was $500, which at that time was about £240, and I ordered it and got sent to Paris, and because I'm smarty pants, I thought, let's keep this safe. So I put the photograph, I thought, safely somewhere. No idea where, but safely somewhere, and kept the book, which is like, that's why I told this thing about 35. The book itself isn't signed and numbered or anything. It's the same catalog book as the regular edition. And then I put on my shelf. And then about 8 months go by, I was living in France, and before we came back to London, we were packing stuff up, and I was packing boxes, and then I went, at one point I went down to the garbage with about 30, those things you get now from Amazon a lot, or from book dealers, cardboard folders that you wrap and twist and stuff, and threw them away, and then I packed my bags and suitcases, and we came back to London, unpacked, and at that point I was unpacking and thought, I better take the photograph out of the box and maybe frame it or put it in a nice place in an album or put it, do something with it. And looked in the Montparnasse box and it wasn't there. And then I realized that I had all along thought, no, I'm not leaving it in the same catalog box because it looks the same as the regular edition. I'll put it somewhere safe. And then it occurred to me where I had put it, where it was safe. I had put it somewhere safe in the cardboard box that they had sent the thing in. And that was on a stack with 20 other empty ones. And it was in the garbage in Paris, now 2 weeks ago, downstairs in the Rue Saint-Maur where I lived. So that's thrown away. So the end of that one is the anxiety of having thrown away a unique photograph. And at one point I even wrote Gursky and said, listen, not as a dealer, as a human being, they're only one of each of these. And this is the story. And I actually had bought this for myself, although book dealers are constantly saying they buy things for themselves or their wives or their girlfriends or their boyfriends just to get a better deal. And 2 seconds later, they stick it in their catalog and sell it. And that joke doesn't work on any of us anymore. But in this case, I actually had bought it for myself. And I thought, I want to frame it. So I thought, I'll tell them the story and say, listen, could you make another copy? Stamp the back, not for sale. Absolutely not original. Call it a copy. Call it a made at Snappy Snaps for $2. I don't care. Make it so it can't be sold for no value. I want the picture so I can frame it, stick it on the wall. I got a letter from the secretary. Mr. Gursky does not make copies of his work. Nice, very, I don't want to say very German, nice, very Middle European answer. Humorless to the point of making you puke your guts out, as Mel Brooks used to say. I mean, you know, one line. Okay, but on the other hand, it's just right. It's too stupid to, you know, dumb story. not terribly anxious, but stupid, me throwing it away. Second story. Third story, Christine Delphi, a radical feminist from Paris, wrote a wonderful essay called The Main Enemy in the very late 60s, early 70s, and which was read in Ronio or papers at feminist conferences. Friends of mine would bring back from various conferences these Ronio papers, and that was one of them. And it was a fabulous essay called The Main Enemy about class and sex and men as a sex class. Well, really good theoretical essay. And then it came out in a book 10 years later called Close to Home with six or seven other essays. And since she was, you know, all the French feminists, was the only one I really, really took to deeply theoretically and read all the time and thought was wonderful and extremely radical. And she ran a magazine called Nouvelle Question Féministe, with which Simone de Beauvoir was the ostensible publisher of, but she was the editor and ran the magazine. Anyway, Delphi and I became very, very good friends. And in fact, we met around the corner from where we're now sitting for the first time, long after reading her stuff. And I just thought, well, first you read the stuff, then if you like it, then you meet and become friends or not the other way around. Because as I was fed up with people who write about artists and they kind of ask them 10 questions and then they write an essay and say, as the artist said, I'm more interested in you saying what you think. Then, if you want to make friends, go ahead. But don't use the backup from the writer or the philosopher or the artist to prove your points. So anyway, having liked her stuff for a very long time, we became very good friends. And then her book came out in hardback. Translated by Diana Leonard, because Christine never did any real work on translation, so this English sociologist, good friend of hers, and did a book called Close to Home, which I loved, and I sent it to a very good friend in New York as a present, and it never arrived. Gone. Just didn't arrive. And it just never got there. And she's a professor at NYU in film, and actually did the first PhD on the English magazine Close Up. But anyway, I sent her this book, and it never got there. And about a year and a half later, I was at her house one day in New York on Thompson Street. We were having dinner, and a friend of hers showed up, who later became a very good friend of mine too, called Lisa Cartwright, who worked for another feminist magazine called Off Our Backs. But anyway, Lisa Cartwright went to Yale and did film, and then to Rochester, then did postdoctoral at Brown, a film academic, but for many years was a good friend. But the point is, at this point, I didn't know her, and she just showed up in the flat where I was staying with my friend, who had never gotten the book a year and a half earlier, and she said, oh, this is my teaching assistant at the moment, Lisa Cartwright. And Lisa said, oh, hello, Peter, I'm Lisa, hello, fine. So the three of us were sitting there, and Lisa pulls out of her bag, a Jiffy bag. She had just been to a police post office auction in the East Village, where once a year they sell lost property. And she said since she was a radical feminist, and this hardback from England was sitting there in the police auction with all the chains and Harley Davidsons and stolen radios, she bought this feminist book for a dollar. And when she opened it up, it said, from Peter with love for X, the other person whom she brought it to. And she handed it to her. It said, this was, Peter sent you this a year and a half ago. I couldn't believe it. Completely weird. So that's the unanxious one. That's the one that doesn't have any anxiety attached to it. Another one is the sort of anxious, which is that Biblion had a big flood the other day, and in London, and of course they claim it's because, according to them, quote, it was very strong rain in the summer. Although I still don't understand how the glass windows know that it's in the summer when it's strong rain, it should leak all over my books. Whereas in the winter, if it's strong rain or snow, it shouldn't leak. Not sure what the time of the year has to do with it. But anyway, they claim that this was there for an act of God. It wasn't an act of bad window making. And the point is, a beautiful book I have, one of my favorite books of all time, called Rubber Stamp Prints. The actual title is Stamped Indelibly. Came out in 1967. It was $75, published by Castelli and Marion Goodman, and had a print. Each page has a rubber stamp print where you make these rubber stamps, but including written stuff, like Allen Ginsberg wrote a poem called Primrose Hill Guru, lovely poem about a 60s hippie type Ginsberg poem. Then there was a Warhol 20 cows, by where each cow is separately done so that each one's actually unique, because someone has to do these 20 cow little 1-inch by 1-inch cows rubber stamps to make a block of 20. And anyway, so wonderful. Oldenburg, a drum, Marisol, the Chilean American pop artist with a Coke bottle and a flower. Anyway, lovely book, linen covered, 200 copies each. tipped in picture, signed a number, the real classic little fetishistic multiples art book, and it got flooded. And because rubber stamp ink is so fugitive, the purple started flowing and the red started flowing, and pages facing pages have... So that's anxious as hell, because that 108 of my books got flooded at Biblion a month ago. That's the one that I really cared about. And so that's sort of anxious, I guess. The next one is Finnegan's Wake, Joyce, signed and numbered edition of, was it 400? Faber, 1939 or something. Wonderful book. And for some reason, I bumped into a book dealer last week who said, only phonies read Joyce. Joyce is just for put a... I won't say who it is. I was very, very shocked. A well-known one-of-us type book deals. People who rejoice, that's just to show off, and no one reads that junk. I said, you're talking about Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses? He said, oh, Ulysses. This is just phony. No one can read that. That's not literature. That's just a show off, and that's unreadable. I said, try Finnegan's Wake. It's wonderful. I don't care that much for Ulysses myself, as it happens. Not because it's fake. I just don't care for it that much. But and it's okay. It's good, but it's not great, I think. But Finnegan's Wake is one of the funniest and greatest books I've ever read. And I've read every word of it, and then you find out that no one's ever actually has read, very few people have actually read it, but they don't think he's a phony. It's just difficult. But anyway, I bought a copy of the signed and numbered edition on eBay, would you believe, from someone, a woman who sold books on eBay. Every once in a while she came up with wonderful books and at relatively reasonable prices, and I bought Finnegan from her, and I bought one or two Becketts as well. And then 6 months later, in the middle of the night, and literally at 4 a.m, I got a phone call from Scotland Yard. And I won't say his name, Detective Inspector, I remember who he is, and he's a really nice guy. But at that point, I was just anxious, because like Kafka says, we're all born with, you know, so much guilt. When Scotland Yard calls you at 4 a.m, you immediately think, you've done some. Because they don't leave you messages saying, this is what we want to know. They say, this is Detective Inspector so-and-so from the... A primary theft squad, Scotland Yard, please call me. And you think, oh shit, what have I done? You know, like, oh God, I'm going to go to jail for life, although I can't remember what I've done. We're all guilty of something, or born guilty, I guess, as Beckett would say. But anyway, or whatever. So I had no end at 4 a.m. The reason it was 4 a.m. was because I was in New York staying with friends for a week and called in to get my messages. And the phone call, I don't know why it was, I still don't know why it was 4 a.m. Well, for some reason it was 4 a.m, I don't know why. But it was scary, and I was, for 3-4 hours, I just thought, fuck me. And then when I finally phoned them at a reasonable hour, Detective Inspector, what's his name, told me the story. How's the tape doing? We're still okay? Told me the story. They'd been monitored. I said, oh, I have, he said, do you have any other books? I said, yes, I have this Becket, and one other book. He said, we know. You know? He said, yes, we've been monitoring your emails for a year. I said, you've been reading my emails for a year? He said, well, technically we're reading her emails for a year. Interpol, the FBI, and Scotland Yard have been on to her for a year. I said, which means my emails, presumably because you're reading hers. I said, oh, that's interesting. I'm glad I did. I sent her an Easter egg, a chocolate Easter egg from Fortnum's. Does that mean you know about that too? But I mean, really, which they did. But the point is, yes, we've been following her for a year. She's been working at the... should I say where? Yes, Cornell Library in the Rare Book Department, and regularly stole books from the reserve lists. And do you still have the books? I said, yeah, I still have them, except for one Becket, which I sold, and that I can get it back. And I got it back and gave the person their money back, and they weren't that happy about it. And I found them a copy, which cost marginally more than mine, bought it and gave it to them, so they didn't have a lost lesson. It was called Lessons of All Things, signed Lessons. But anyway, they've been monitoring her, talk about lessness. And I brought the books back into them. It's right next to the murder squad if you go in on the fifth floor. Yeah, it's really scary, I'll tell you. Because at first, when you get the phone call, you just think, God damn it. You know, we want to talk to you. Is this Mr. Goodall? We'd like to talk to you. Talk to me? About what? What? Anything particular? You can't do that. It's a machine message. Anyway, he was very nice. I brought him the books back. And I said, do we get anything out of this? After a while, when I calmed down a day later, 2 days later, I was back in London. I said, I'm coming back to London in a week, and I'll bring them in. I came back, brought them in, and he said, well, actually, thanks for the books, we return them. It first goes to the FBI, then they go through them all, then they return them to Cornell. And I said, but Cornell has heavy insurance from Prudential Life Insurance, or whatever it's called. And so in the end, what I did is I saved the Prudential Insurance Company's shareholders. Mm-hmm. 8,500 pounds. I saved the shareholders, which didn't make me feel particularly good either. Not so much as a note, a thank you, and the same James, what's his name, from Red Snapper, James Allen, he had a wonderful book, which he outbid me on eBay for, which was hand-lettered by Lucia Joyce, a book she did, Joyce's daughter. He bought that one for £5,500. Also, so he brought his back, I brought mine back, none of us ever got a penny, all straight loss, not even a tax deduction, just a loss. Anyway, but anxious, very, very anxious phone call, Finnegan. The other one was, let's see, I'm almost there, I scribbled down the name of the books, Nabokov's father, Vladimir Nabokov's father, very wealthy St. Petersburg, white Russian, whatever it's called. Anti-Bolshevik, was in jail in St. Petersburg during the Russian Revolution, but because he very wealthy family, very powerful family, he was in jail but treated well, and he had his he had a Dante's Inferno, beautiful red leather, glossy red leather bound for him by his binder in St. Petersburg with his little monogram in the middle, beautiful plain red leather, which he read in prison. His copy of Dante's Inferno, read in prison, a slim volume, beautiful red leather. And somehow, I can't remember where I bought it, to be honest. I usually remember these things. I can't remember. But it was sold to Horowitz in New York from my second catalog, and it never arrived. Disappeared. Heavily insured, in the mail, beautiful, and scribbles in it by Nabokov's father in jail, commenting on the Italian, commenting on Dante. I mean, like, just so interesting, because the son must have had it at some point. God knows how it got to me here. But anyway, sent to Horowitz, who bought it in New York, and gone. Something beeping, meaning it's dead? Something's beeping.
Did you hear something?
Yeah, I heard something beeping. Anyway, we're almost done.
It's not your water. You don't have a phone.
Oh, it's probably my phone beeping, which I don't listen to. Yeah, because it's got no battery left. Yeah.
I hope that's what it is, and not this...
One new message, yep.
That's what it is.
One new message.
I wonder what it was. I was beginning to wonder, worry that it was a tape.
No, one new message. That's it. I was wondering it was a tape. Nope.
Carry on.
So that was very anxious, because it's a beautiful book, and it's one of the few I really thought I'd keep, because Dante, beautiful volume, red leather, how can you beat it? And small, the size of a paperback, you could stick it in your in your vest pocket. So that's disappeared. Very anxious, I thought. Didn't arrive. No tracking, no tracing. We're very sorry. And in those days, I used to use the post office still, so I think it was probably, I probably did something so that it would get through at that time, insured for 60 quid or so. I used to do that all the time. So nothing, gone. I think there's only one left of these anxious books. And that is Bridget Polk, who was in Chelsea Girls and kept shooting herself up with all sorts of drugs and uppers through her jeans in Chelsea Girls, and then became an assistant to Warhol, who watched the factory like a hawk. So when you walked into the factory, when I used to visit every year, she'd always look at everyone to see who you were, especially if you were going to shoot someone. And she was always at the door. And then a friend of mine bumped into her in a knitting shop in the East Village, because she became a knitter. And she'd sit around in this little knitting shop, and they'd all talk about stitches and cross stitches and what kind of Rowan yarns to use. She became a completely different person. Or maybe it isn't a different person. But anyway, Bridget Polk used to take Polaroids and did them of artists, did them of Andy Warhol, did them of other people at the factory, and she did these lovely little books of 8 Polaroids in a little phony leather, the way you get them in high school in the States, or here too in those days, sort of faux leather volume with a little ring binder, which is small, 5 inches by 4 inches, and you could put the Polaroids behind plastic, 8 or 10 in an album, and she made these albums, and I had one of them with 8 or 10 pictures of her and Warhol and 1 or 2 other people at the factory, and they were sold as her books. And when I moved from Holland Road to Lansdowne Crescent in 1989, a company called Bishop's Moves who may they rot in hell for eternity, came by. Five lovely men, really lovely guys who'd been working them for years, helped me pack everything up in Holland Road, 20 years worth of stuff to move it around the corner in their truck. But they had a young assistant who was working with them to help, quote unquote. And I caught him on the way to the bathroom from the living room, which is down some steps in my little flat in Holland Road, and he was rifling through my wallet, which he had, I saw it, he had it in his hand. And being in such an anxious state, which they say, divorce and moving house, they're so anxious. And I was just about to get the key for the new house and waiting for it and paying this huge amount of money and checks going through banks and them calling and someone bringing the key, that I was in this servile state of saying, then excuse me, that's my wallet. You're going to, oh, I thought this was just something on the shelf. And he had my wallet. He had pictures in it of friends of mine. And I took the wallet back and I said, just keep to the packing, please, and don't go rifling my stuff. And he stole the Bridget Polk book. He stole a photograph of Cecil that Cecil Beaton took of Andy Warhol that was signed by both of them to me. And he stole a third picture by Michael Cooper, which is actually on the back of my Warhol book, where Warhol's looking from left to right in six different directions of Michael Cooper, who lived around the corner before he died of a heroin overdose. He actually made the picture for me for the book, brought it over, just printed it, brought it over, and it was sitting there. And that the Beaton photograph and the little album by Polk were all sort of together as rare photo things on the corner. And I even said it to the Bishop's Moves guys, please be careful with this. This is rare photo stuff. Let's put this on top of a box. 10 seconds later, I went in the other room, came back up, gone. And I said, where's that guy who was helping you? Oh, he's left. He's left. And he's going back to Italy. He's leaving today. This was his last day here. And I was in such a state that I didn't then immediately just call the fucking police. I didn't do anything. I just said, but he just stole stuff from me. Are you sure? Why? 99.9% sure. He'd been rifling my wallet, which had been in a drawer, closed, and he was standing in the hallway 20 feet away looking through it. How did it get from one place to the other? 10 minutes later, so in the end, they moved my stuff. They were lovely old guys, but he was their ripoff guy. He was the guy who stole stuff. Absolutely not a chance. There's no way. It just doesn't lift. They didn't stick it in there. He did it. He was gone. Oh, he's gone now. That was his last job. He's now gone. And I wrote their people, and they wrote back and said, and I said, I don't want to accuse someone. I don't know if I can't say it. I can't swear by it. My eternal soul shouldn't rot in hell if I'm wrong. But I'm not as sure as you can be. And their lawyer wrote back and said, thank you for being so generous about this and not accusing him outright of theft, but saying you think it's probably him, could we talk to him? He's gone, we can't talk to him. And by the way, if you read part 14B of Bishop's Moves Insurance, we don't cover that. You virtually go to hell. We don't. So every time I see Bishop's Moves, I do some kind of, old Arab trader or Jewish trader spitting at the camels or whatever camels do when they load someone's, and may they rot forever, Bishop's Moves. But the anxious part is that this little book by Bridget Polk of Warhol and Friends, and it's a lovely little book, and gone, anxious. So, Gursky, Klein, Delphi, Stanton, Delavley, Finnegan's Wake, Joyce, Bridget Polk, Nabokov's father, and the very last was my dear friend Roger Hammond, who had a book by Jim Dine and Lee Friedlander called Notes from the Same House. Photographs on one side by Friedlander, etchings on the other side by Dine, and a lovely book he found in the East End for £1, but it was a limited edition of 50 original photographs, beautiful etchings of Dine, not so beautiful, but still a real nice book dealer type book. And then Roger died a couple years ago, and I used to visit him in this hospice and bring him homemade Irish cakes I made, and we would chat about stuff, and he always meant, oh, and that book, the mumble, the book, and then other things, and anyway, he died. I went to his house afterwards with his mom about 3 months later and went through his stuff. And the book had turned into, this isn't an anxious story, this is just a funny story. It was the normal £1 version of the same book, which exists as well, which is not the photographs and etching. So it shows that the anxiety that it was lost, I was sort of anxious because it was gone. I was telling his mother, find this book and, you know, put it into Sotheby's or something. And it turned, and she was looking for it, and I was looking for it. And then we found, there's no question, it wasn't that ever. It was a fan, so some anxieties come out of fantasy. You know, you think and which is what dealers do. They think things up. This is original. This is a real signature. This is a definite. This was a wonderful 1 pound, very scrappy, scruffy book called Notes from the Same House, printed by Petersburg Press. Not the one with the so this wasn't really anxious. It was only anxious while we were looking for it. Then when we found it, it was funny. It was typical my friend Roger. It was a perfect Roger story. He always had the other one, implied it was the one, it was the other, never had it. And you think, oh, even better than anxiety. It's just funny. And so that's the end of my stories about anxious books.